Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. So today on the podcast, we're going to talk about innovation and entrepreneurialism in the wine sector. And I've got the best possible guest to do that, Jonathan Stain, a former restaurateur, wine judge and wine columnist. He's got an academic background in business administration and has done his PhD at the University of Cape Town Graduate School of Business, which is one of the best business schools in the world. He's a research fellow. He convenes the Wine Business Management and Hospitality Leadership Program at the university. And he does all kinds of things. His research interests include business collective action, market creation, and innovation. And he also somehow finds the time to run his own consultancy business, focusing on business collective strategy, and it's called Collective Vantage. That is a lot. Okay, you've had an incredibly varied career from being a restaurateur and wine writer. How did you end up being a lecturer and researcher in wine business?
Yeah, Felicity, I guess my life was a lot simpler back then. I absolutely love the restaurant business. I got involved in it because I'm also passionate about cultural industries, so fashion, music, art.
Okay.
All these tourism, etc., are all cultural industries and of great interest to me. I think I enjoy the creativity that these businesses offer. I enjoy engaging in the creative process, and I think they are industries where innovation is incredibly important, and I have a passion for innovation. So yeah, I decided to change careers in around 2010. I was involved in a group of restaurants. One was a steakhouse, and we were sort of focused on, we had the largest wine by the glass selection in the world. We brought and built our own taps, and we were kind of in blue ocean. And that's sort of where I got introduced to concepts like blue ocean and the experience economy, which was really changing markets globally at that point in time. And then I decided to change careers, and I went to study abroad did a master's degree in wine business.
Where?
So it's through, at that stage, it was through both Paris, University of Paris, Nanterre, and Montpellier Soup Agro. So it's the official program of the OIV. So it's the OIV MSc in wine management that is still running today. And that's an incredible program because you basically do blocks all over the world at various universities, meet a lot of people in almost every region. So I guess it was a way for me to escape, to take a sabbatical and to reboot, I guess. Restaurant business is incredibly tough.
Yeah.
And is incredibly demanding on your time. I absolutely loved it. The satisfaction that you get from it is unparalleled, but it is very draining. And ultimately, I looked to a new path for my career. I didn't have any idea that I would fall into academia or consulting. I just trusted my gut and sort of made the leap, and I'm really grateful. And then when I completed that course, I came back to South Africa and wasn't quite sure what I should do. I'd done quite well, and people suggested maybe academia was a good career path. I got a kind of a scholarship at that stage, and then I mulled over it. I did some consulting work, and then eventually decided to, for the good or the bad, embark on my PhD. Which is a religious experience and a journey for anybody attempting it. And obviously focused on the wine business. While I was a restaurateur, I was very wine focused. I judged on competitions and for magazines, and also wrote a column. I mean, it wasn't a serious, hard-hitting, I wasn't a serious, hard-hitting wine columnist. It was more for fun and lifestyle-orientated, which I really enjoyed. It was a break from the restaurant world. And then the dean was present at a presentation I did, and they had a dormant program in wine business through the UCT GSB, and I had run in a collaboration with the University of Adelaide for many years. And so he wanted to really reboot it and to reposition it, and they had applicants in the pipeline. And we were sort of chasing a deadline to redo and reposition this course. And so we did that. And then 2015, we started with our first cohort. And there wasn't an appetite for a year-long degree program. I think most wine businesses are SMEs or SMMEs, small to medium-sized enterprises. And so they really can't afford their people to take a year off, often to do an MBA or a year-long postgraduate diploma in wine business. But a three-month boot camp, which was on the same level, sort of hit the spot. So we built the course around two things: leadership and innovation. We weren't trying to necessarily teach strategy, finance, marketing, and so forth, although those were part of the content of the course. The main focus was to teach people critical thinking, problem solving, creativity, and really importantly, cognitive agility. That's the ability to take a bunch of concepts and to combine them into a useful whole. And I think
how do you do that? I would love to know.
You throw a lot of information at people, and you get them to they either sink or swim, and they learn to work with each other productively to divide the work up in such a way that they can produce one product out of many people, and they're able to take all these varying concepts to put them into frameworks and to understand, well, how do I apply them? But more importantly, why am I applying them, and what problem am I trying to solve in the business?
Okay, so there's a lot to talk about there. So my own, I'll just start by saying I've seen many wine MBA programs start up in Europe, and I'm very cynical about many of them because they focus a lot on things like sensory evaluation. And I went to the graduating class of one, and I said, you know, congratulations, the wine trade really needs more people with knowledge of finance. And they said, oh, we didn't do any finance. I was like, what were you doing? And they said, oh, you know, sensory evaluation and so on. So part of the reason I wanted to talk to you is that you actually do have a very serious business focus. I think you told me that some of it's based on the Harvard case study model. Can you talk that through?
Okay, so basically we have two forms of evaluation, which is rapidly changing in the sense that AI can give you almost every answer on every multiple choice question you ask. You know, are you testing for content is not the question anymore. The question is, do you have an adaptable understanding of it? Do you have the critical thinking, creativity, problem solving ability? That AI can't really teach you, right? So we require two things both on a group level within the contact phase of the course, and then on an individual level in the post-contact phase. Basically, it's a business plan. So they have to either, because we look at it, if they work for a big company, it's a form of intrapreneurship, right? Where you're driving new innovation, new campaigns, new products that you're developing, brand extensions, so forth. Or it's an entrepreneurship exercise where you're driving a new venture, for example, or breathing life into an existing venture, right? So we teach them all the components, how to put that together successfully. And you obviously that requires a really good understanding of various metrics, you know, time value of money, you know, financials, a marketing brand plan, because a business plan encapsulates a whole range of plans, from a governance plan to a financial plan to a brand plan to a marketing plan. And they all sort of fit nest in each other. So, and they all borrow from each other. So we teach them that holistic way to do it. The second is to analyze cases. And these are teaching cases. So they're based on real life scenarios, but we do make some up scenarios up, which are based on real life during teaching them how to analyze a case effectively. So we go about, like, how do you frame the problem?
Okay, so what are the most pressing challenges you hear from students and industry people who come into your program? Like, what are the things that you're hearing stress points right now? And I mean, obviously, you know, lack of resources and so on is always a stress point in the wine industry. But what are you particularly hearing about at the moment?
Look, there's so many facets to that question. I think also the sort of leadership's framework or the governance structure of organizations sometimes are a bit archaic. They tend to be very hierarchical. And so the information flow is constrained, right? And people tend to work in silos. So, for example, a winemaker's very rarely will have a conversation with the marketing team or with the finance team. And so you have the siloing information, and if you have siloing information, it stops innovation. Innovation is created by new information coming into a system. So that also works with inter-organizational collaboration, for example, working with others, not just in your region, but outside of your region. Because it comes down to a guy called Mark Granovetter, wrote a paper called The Strength of Weak Ties in 1973, more or less coming up with the whole idea behind social networks, right? And the issue he was confronting is, well, how do you inspire innovation, and how do you inspire, in that case, people to find jobs? And they didn't find jobs through their immediate circle. They found it through the weak ties of those people within their circle.
That's really interesting because, I live in a rural wine region, and I can see one of the key challenges is that the networks aren't thick enough for people to really, bump up against new ideas and so on. So given that the wine trade is very, well, the wine industry is very rural, how do you introduce new ideas into the system? Other than people going on social media or reading the newspaper or something.
Yeah, I think this is what we're trying to teach people. I mean, I don't think there is a silver bullet to that. I think they have to engage. They have to go outside of their comfort zone. And so one of the things that we do push, we push people to their absolute limits is so that they can step out of their comfort zone, because it's very comfortable to just say, okay, I'm in a rural environment. What kind of effort must I make? But we call it boundary crossing. You need to cross those boundaries in order to access the information that's valuable. So I also think that people stick to what has worked in the past.
That's a key weakness.
Times change and you have to adapt. And if you don't access the information that's available, there's no new innovation that can happen, right? And a lot of that is relationally based, relational energy.
One thing that's an absolute key weakness in the region around me is that there's been a long, there's a 750-year tradition. And so a lot of wineries and cooperatives have only ever had to sell to their local neighbourhood. And now the locals are getting older, or they're giving up wine, and people have no idea about how to seek out new markets or even the basics of how to do that. And that's, so it's like, even if the market in the local area was good, they should have been out there seeking out new markets anyway, just to keep sort of in the swim. All right, so that's obviously a challenge. And the challenge of innovation is a really big one in the wine industry. What sort of points of resistance do you see?
Well, I think that I think the resistance is a lot to sort of changing mindset, right, and being agile. I think that's the problem, because I think it's more prevalent, as you said, in areas that have a long heritage, right? When you get new blood coming in, there's a huge sort of resistance to that.
Yeah.
And I think that it's really around education, you know, and I think it's sometimes very difficult when you have, a huge rules-based system. So in Europe, probably a lot more difficult, where you have AOC rules, you have regional rules that are very constraining. In the new world, I guess, if you can call it that, it's probably a little bit more democratic and freer. The kind of innovation approach to innovation is different. But, you know, I think there's a fallacy when it comes to innovation that it has to be radical. Innovation can be incremental, right? So if you have one big idea and you take 10 years to work on it, your chance of success might be 50-50, but let's say it's successful, it's one big innovation. It's a radical revolutionary innovation. But if you look at what happens, you know, in the Japanese car manufacturing industry, you know, they make around 600, you know, some factories make over 600 small incremental innovations every day, right? And over time, that innovation builds up to a tidal wave, right? And so the company, after 10 years, looks completely different. So it doesn't mean, innovation doesn't mean, okay, suddenly I'm going to all of a sudden reinvent myself. It's working on the small things from a day-to-day basis that can, over time, make a greater impact than one new idea or one new way of looking at it.
I have an example of that. About 15 years ago, I was passing through Frankfurt Airport on my way to Washington, D.C., and I put my luggage on the thing, and the woman who was checking me never touched the luggage because the conveyor belt just took it. Mm. And then when I checked in Washington, I put my bag on the thing, and the woman had to physically pick up the bag and put it on the conveyor belt behind her. And I said to somebody, why is this? It must wreck a bet. And they said, because in Germany, they like incremental change, whereas in America, there's no value in incremental change. You need to make big changes.
Yes.
So there's all these little glitches in the system that don't have to be there because everybody's looking for the big thing rather than the little thing.
Yeah. So, and then one also has to distinguish between innovations that occur within the company and those innovations that are targeted towards the external environment, right?
Oh, you have to explain that.
So within a company, it could be sort of a lean manufacturing program where you're making these incremental changes in the technology you use, where, how you organize your winery, for example, how you organize your distribution and dispatch channels, your logistics, etc. And so that's really important. And I think in South Africa, that's a gap. That you can create greater efficiencies and less defects in your line. So those are small incremental changes within the business that you can make. There's also we're going back to the flow of information, right? How do you create high-performing teams? How do you inspire innovation by the way in which you work together, right? And that's about building governance structures. That's about embedding purpose of the company into every team. That's about preventing siloing. That's creating a culture of trust, right? We don't have to rely on hierarchical structures where there's low power and a high trust relationship. And what happens then is that you have a greater flow of information amongst people in the organization that really inspires innovation. And then that also generates greater energy. And what happens is in those situations, people are able to solve problems a lot quicker.
Let's talk again because I am based in Europe and I'm thinking about Europe, which is of course very different from the New World. But you know, one one killer here is exactly this, and it's the family-owned structure where the family is. We've always done it that way. So when you go into businesses, how do you bust that up? How do you rearrange things so that people are comfortable sharing information?
Okay, so it's all around finding your common values, right? And your values are your beliefs that matter to you, because beliefs ultimately guide your behavior, right? So the purpose of the organization is nothing more than a set of beliefs as to why you're doing what you're doing, why you exist as an organization. So that's kind of a key thing. And in some of my consulting works, I've worked with quite a few family businesses, and it's often a very tricky space. And you're dealing with sets of values. And the thing about values is how you prioritize the values is important, right? Because for some people, honesty is the number one, but other things, achievement might be higher. So I'll use a sort of model on how we look at it. So there's two sets of opposing values. There's those values that are pivoted towards achievement. So I want to, you know, gain X market share. My wines need to be win lots of medals. So it's really about self-care. Then there's, on the opposite end of the spectrum, is caring for others, and we call these self-transcendent values, right? There's benevolence and looking after people in your organization. And often these two stand in tension, right? And on the other set, it's the one towards change, pivoted towards change, and the other pivoted towards tradition or remaining the same or stability, right? And you find that family businesses are often in that area, right? And what happens is if you are wanting to dwell or prioritize values that are about stability, you destroy innovation. But then on the other side, too much innovation all the time creates chaos and lack of direction, right? So one has to balance these two. On the other side, you know, wanting to only care about people, you lose sight of the core objective of business, which is to be profitable enough to do what you need to do and to be societally relevant, right? So you find that that businesses who only think about achievement often get caught up in ethical issues, right? Manipulating wines in a certain way, etc.
Interesting.
People who are too focused maybe on prioritizing, only looking after people, the environment, maybe lose sight that sustainability, for want of a better word, starts with getting the right price and being profitable, and then creates the money that's to look after people and the environment and to be sustainable. So one has to, so the answer is, how do you get people? You get them to prioritize the values.
So this almost sounds like psychotherapy. How do you go in and first of all, how do you tease out what the values are? And then once you've done it, how do you say to somebody, look, I understand that you want to get 100 points and whatever, but you know, adulterating your wines with you know, this isn't the way to do it. How do you manage that?
So we teach people. So I'll use an example from our students, because we throw them into a group together. So it might be a sommelier, it might be a winemaker, marketer, journalist, all in one group, and they have to produce a single product, right? And they all have to sort of speak with one voice, so to speak. How do you get everybody to work together? So there's three. So before we started on this, what we call collaborative innovation, teaching them how to collaborate effectively, which we use the values. So we use a survey, an instructive survey to do that. We use an instructive survey also on the innovation side, lack of siloing, governance, etc. So two instructive surveys, their collaborative profile, and then their values profile. And then we instruct them on how to align those and to the to give them the tools to be able to work according to their values and to according to a framework around collaborative innovation. And before we did that, there was so much conflict in the groups. You know, some people wouldn't even talk to each other. I mean, it's all MBA groups. I think you can ask or any business school group work is beset, and it's conflict. And if you don't have conflict resolution practices, it derails innovation, right? And so we've worked on that a lot, and we've also tried to make them understand their own personal development, how they can develop themselves through things like strength-based leadership, these kind of tools. So it's kind of the psychological, but also working with them to teach them how to collaborate effectively.
Yeah,
and that's really the rocket science.
Yeah.
And that's what they really, one of the big outcomes of the course is actually how to work in effectively in teams and how to innovate in teams. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. As you're talking about, you know, different values, one thing I've observed over my years of talking to people in the wine trade is people tend to be motivated either by status and prestige or by money. But what happens from what I see is people mistake their own motivations. So quite often people think they're in business to make money, but it's very clear they're actually in business for the prestige. And you can have both of those things if you're clear about what you want. But many people don't tell themselves the truth about what they actually want out of the wine business.
Yes. So, I mean, that is true because, you know, under those broader value sets, there's, for example, power, which is this quest for power and status and prestige. And then there's the other, which is around hedonism or, you know, I want pleasure in life. I want to get, you know, so there's various components that fit together and they all have individual sets of values that speak to that. So understanding what motivates people because it's their value system, because values are beliefs that guide action, right? So it's at the core of what motivates people in business.
Yeah. You were talking a few minutes ago about internal innovation. Tell me about external innovation.
Okay. So there, once again, it can be on a spectrum from evolutionary to revolutionary, right? So if you look at sort of strategic innovation, we're looking at strategic types of strategic innovation. Those are kind of radical and looking at the external environment. So these are things like blue ocean strategy, which is, you know, Yellowtail used successfully in the 90s. I don't know how they're doing with that right now, but how they were.
What was it about them that was blue ocean?
So they were able to find uncontested space in the budget wine market in America at that time by creating a sort of sense of fun and adventure, which appealed to beer drinkers, for example, taking the all the vocabulary out of wine, the complicated vocabulary. So they really simplified their offering for consumers, but they were able to actually reduce costs as well. So that's why they call Blue Ocean value innovation. It's both differentiation, finding your place of differentiation, being different in a different way, because a lot of people are different in the same way, and then doing it at a lower cost. So, for example, what Yellowtail were doing is they were hiring students to go into wine shops dressed as typical Australians, you know, with a corks on it, the safari suit kind of thing, and pouring wine. So to bring that experience to consumers, cutting out above the line advertising. So that was a way in which they could find uncontested space or blue ocean. And so that still remains, I think, one of the key things that we teach on the program is how to find that uncontested space. Yeah.
The other thing about Yellowtail is that the Australian dollar was to the US dollar at the time that they entered the market. And it's very it's very interesting to me. I did a sort of project once when I was editor of Miningers where I tracked currency for a while, and I could always see that you get these great successes when the currency was low against the US dollar. Mm. So the Australian category slammed into the wall once the dollar reached parity with the US. And, and there was all this sort of weeping and wailing about, you know, we've lost our way and, you know, we were too greedy and we were this. And then I saw Argentina go through the same thing with Malbec, that when the peso was good, you know, the thing was like, oh, they offer great value for money, and people like, well, they've recognized our greatness. And then when the peso strengthened, it was like, where did we go wrong? And so much of this seems to me to be driven by currency as much as
super interesting. Yeah. So I think in our sort of premiumization stuff, we're looking at currency and inflation and seeing how that's affected it. You know, patterns in the north and southern hemisphere. So, yeah, I mean, there's other sort of things like experiential innovation. It's like, how do you modify the touch points, the consumer touch points, in a way that delivers a memorable, compelling, and unique experience in your brand experience DNA, and that can be either radical or incremental. And then there's disruptive innovation that everybody is harping on about. And so there's quite a few, and then there's sustainability innovation, which is around societal relevance, right? How do you innovate? And this whole new thing with transcendent value, with new generations in the market, that these wines that are organic in certain markets, I would say, organic or biodynamic, have some sort of social certification, such as fair trade, etc., are starting to now show premiums, whereas 10 years ago that was not the case. So there's a new sort of value that's emerging, which they identified actually around 20 years ago, called transcendent value. This is buying on the basis of the moral compass. So you buy on the basis of an alignment between your values and the values of the business, or the values that embodies the offering of the business. And that connection between your values and that those values are then what promotes premium and it promotes purchase.
So you're teaching people to be entrepreneurs in an environment where there's very little money available. How much innovation is it possible to do without cold hard cash?
Look, I think we have to be realistic, and I think the there is a challenge, I think, especially around seed funding for entrepreneurs in the wine industry. And so money is, cash flow is always a challenge. And I think it's business models, you know, I think is an important aspect to that, is like really to define your business model, what is achievable. Because business models really define how you make money. And it's around the mission of your company. So a lot of people, think of going in the wine business as you own land. Right? You own land, you build a winery, you sell to, you know, you export, you sell to wholesalers, retailers, and certain direct-to-consumer markets. But there's so much more, and it requires so much more agility in what you do. And you really have to sort of find the streams of revenue that you are able to realistically achieve with your resources. So business model and a mission of a company is around three things. Who is your customer? What is your value proposition? What makes you attractive to the market you're trying to target? And then what are your resources? So the combination of those three things is going to give you the answer. So I think the question is to manage people's expectations, right? So if people are going, okay, I'm going to buy a winery, I'm going to buy vineyards, I'm going to do a winery. You know, I had a student come up with a very, very innovative business plan, which actually was around branding regeneratively farmed grapes, right? So they could hire the vineyards, farm them as they wanted. They had some capital backing, and it was an entrepreneurial project in combination with partnerships. And she just very successfully justified that who in the wine industry is branding, apart from regional branding, where Burgundy sort of buys from certain appellations on Worth, and then they will use that as a brand for on their labels. But super innovative things like that, I think, come across, like understanding what is my core competencies, what are my core resources, right? If you're bootstrapping, you're starting with a wine brand, you know, do you want to farm? Find the right resources, outsource that. Which is going to be the best channels to go in? Are the wholesalers going to take too much of my margins? How can I successfully go through the direct to consumer channel? Right. So I think examining that is really important. Then from guys who have traditional sort of wineries, wine can be one of a suite of products that you produce, right? So I know some guys who are producing herbs and they produce wine. They've got a restaurant, they've got a hotel or accommodation. And so they've got multiple revenue streams. So to understand how to put that together, I think is really important. And then they're able to create sort of specific and measurable and most importantly, realistic objectives for their business and understand their constraints, but also understand their opportunities. So I think that's what we can teach them how to do and what to do. And I think if there's more sort of focus on that, then I think they're able to find the value that will drive the future success of their business. But I don't think people ask a lot of questions about their business model. And when entrepreneurs begin on this, they're not asking the right question.
Oh, that's
interesting. So we want to put them in the right position to do that. There's no guarantee for success. But we teach them the importance of cash flow as well, and how to manage their cash flow correctly.
So changing gears altogether, you've often noted that South African wines are undervalued. Why are they, and how would the country be able to change this?
Well, you're asking me to solve the entire country.
I am asking it right now. You've got to get on it.
I think you'll have to wait. The jury's out. It's actually the subject of major research program, that's funded by SA Wine as well, who are very interested in this question. But maybe I can just frame it for you, because I think we're go back to when I talked about sustainability, and I think South Africa was one of the first countries, maybe because of the legacy that we have, to introduce, the IPW seal and the Wine Industry Ethical Trade Association, certification. So from that side, we've made quite a lot of advances in what we're doing in terms of sustainability in South Africa. And I think that trend is growing. But I think the major thing that we need to confront is getting the right price for our product. So if you also have to look at it in a global context, because if you look at the South versus the North, in 1990, only 1% of the value and volume of wine in the world came from the South. Mm. Only 15% of wine was exported in 1990. That figure is now over 40%. Mm. So it's a greater internationalization of wine. If you look at the chunk of volume and value that the South is occupying, it's around 20% in volume and 23% in value, or vice versa, I can't remember. But certainly the entire wine category has premiumized over time, right? So we're talking about premiumization as a phenomena and premiumization or premiumizing as a strategy, right? Yeah. I think you're talking about premiumizing as a strategy. And so I think there's been a huge, leap, growth in the premiumization and the internationalization. I mean, this is what Kim Anderson's papers have really been about. Super interesting reading. So I think South Africa, if you look at our price point, our unit value, we've just overtaken Spain at around $3.05 a liter exported packaged still wine, right? Which drives around 73% of the value of exports. So you really build your brand and you create the value through packaged wine, right? So South Africa has just overtaken Spain, but whereas we are seventh or eighth globally in terms of volume, we're 10th or 11th out of the top 11 mainstream wine producing countries, who occupy around between 85 and 90% of global volume and value in the export market. So when you say premium, I think premiumization, it has a number of connotations, which I'm not really going to get into. It can mean, it doesn't mean making everything expensive or going into luxury wine trade, which people tend to think it means. It means across all tiers, improving your pricing, your price that you are getting for wine. So, and there really was a strong surge through COVID, and there was a bit of a correction, but I think the general trajectory, and people can correct me, but what we are seeing is the general trajectory, and especially in the South, is upward. So it's very important to, especially in declining consumption, as we're experiencing right now in this cycle, because I actually had a look at some figures from a presentation I went to with the OIV, where they've actually looked at figures since 1924 to 2025 and looked at the cycles of consumption and production. And one sees patterns that emerge over time, and maybe there'll be less panic if we maybe take a longer time horizon and look at what the wine industry has experienced over time.
So what are you saying? This is just a normal dip.
I can't tell you that honest truth. We're at the moment, and we're busy analysing some really interesting suite of drivers to look at, what's affecting it. But one thing is true is that global consumption per capita has definitely dropped. Whereas in 1990, I think it was around 4.4 liters per capita per annum. It's now below 2.7. So there is this decline in consumption. So I guess driving volume is going to be tricky in this sort of market conditions. And I qualify that in mature markets. So US and Europe, I think, we can look at them as relatively mature markets. Whether that holds, and there is evidence suggests that it doesn't necessarily, because generations in different areas of the world are different. The consumption patterns in emerging markets, in Africa especially, is becoming very interesting to a lot of players, where there's a huge growth in the middle class and there's a different kind of set of.
Do you think, Kes, that's really interesting. So in countries where you've got this emerging middle class and they want Western brands and so on, do you think that as people embrace wine, they will adopt the consumption patterns that are happening in the West? So, less wine but better quality? Or do you think the consumption patterns will look as they did historically, which is that people buy lots and lots of cheaper wines, drink a lot, and then gradually trade up as they get older? If I made that clear.
That's a tough question. I don't think it's going to be the same necessarily. I think emerging markets specifically have a lot of challenges and require a completely different approach to, right? Not just on the consumer. So, you know, what are emerging markets characterized? Volatility, huge changes. You know, South Africa is an emerging market as well. Our local market, I think the vast majority of wine sells for under 100 rand on local market.
What's that in US dollars?
So you divide by 20, so
it's $5.
$5, yeah. So the vast majority sells for under that. So firstly, volatility. If you look at the rand dollar exchange, you look at the Brazilian real, you know, those are extremely volatile currencies. You mentioned currencies, right? I'll get back to volatility, a super interesting presentation I went to around that. And then they're unequal, right? Big difference between wealthy and incomes, right? So very wealthy and very poor, like reflected by the Gini coefficient. And then they're complex. So the infrastructure, you know, your distribution methods your distribution is very challenged often in emerging markets because of infrastructural constraints. So partnerships become really important. And so I think there's likely to be a very unique approach required to marketing wine in emerging markets. The other important thing is, how do you create the cultural connection with countries that traditionally don't drink wine, right? So how do we change our approach from a Western approach, right? Is that we describe wines, for example, with gooseberries and, you know, but people across the world might not understand what a gooseberry is, or they might have something of a similar flavor that's aligned with the food of their choice. So we need to adapt a lot more to creating a culture of consumption around wine and our messaging, and the way we market our wine and we promote our wine, it needs to be completely different. And so I heard there's a really great podcast with Liz Thatch, American Marketing Council, where she talks about, you know, we create advertisements around wine where the people in the adverts look like us rather than the people we're trying to target. And so we need to explore new, diverser markets. I think that's kind of maybe the secret to this whole thing, where we can unlock value over time, where that value can be volume or it can be extra premium.
Do you think the wine trade should be following other sectors, craft beer, tech? Are there other sectors that are doing, you know, that are entering new markets and doing it really well, or other sectors that are coming up with marketing ideas that might be something that the wine trade should have a look at?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think that the tech sector is really interesting, just in the way that they have created these clusters of innovation, which is really super interesting. You know, if you look at Silicon Valley and et cetera, I think the wine industry are very afraid of competition because it's such a hyper-competitive space. They're very wary of competition. But often, you know, having a lot of competitors in a small space is actually a competitive advantage, and we need to just try and
understand. That's an interesting idea. How would you physically do that in wine, where everyone's spread out in rural regions?
Well, I mean, California Wine Cluster is a famous example of how they were able to change the consumption patterns in America incredibly over between 76. You know, in 70, around just before the judgment of Paris, you know, consumption in America was around 6 liters per capita. It's now about 10. And when you talking about 300 odd million people, that's a lot. And how they were able to do was create this cluster involving people who were competitive And the competition was important, but it also collaborated. So this whole idea around co-opetition. And I think successful industries, I think that is vital. And when we go back to the siloing, sharing information, creating this relational energy, I think we're talking the same language. It's a bit difficult when you have geographically distributed wine regions. How do you create a golden thread? How do you create a single voice that runs through them?
Yeah, I think that is absolutely the Achilles heel here in Europe. I mean, both Australia and New Zealand have very collaborative industries, New Zealand particularly. But here, people won't be even in the same room sometimes with it's different with the younger generation, I think. But that sense of, you know, play your cards close to your chest and so on. But you're saying that's a weakness to be like that.
Yes, to a certain extent. I think vigorous competition is important because it creates innovation in itself. But when you're not collaborating productively, that can be destructive.
Okay, just in the last few minutes, how do you interpret the decline of wine among younger people? Do you think it's a trend or do you think it's a generational shift that the wine trade is going to have to grapple with seriously?
I don't know what you mean by trend. I don't know how long it will carry on for. I was looking, and once again, go and look at the 100-year stats for the OIV when they release, and it's kind of... looks like we're on a lowish point, but with lower volatility actually than we had in previous years, especially over the past 100 years. But generational change, I think we tend to look at generations. I mean, and now we're talking mature wine markets,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
As homogenous groupings of people, and they're not always the case. And I think the millennials are sort of had drove the craft, the sort of craft movement to a certain extent. You know, this individualization, this uniqueness around.
Whereas us Gen Xers just drank what we were given.
Yes, exactly.
we had no standards.
But these millennials are starting to occupy a bigger portion of the market, right? So we're getting the whole idea around authenticity being very important, this whole idea around craft being incredibly important, additives in wine, natural wines. That was sort of I think inspired by the millennial generation who are occupying. Now, Gen Z or Gen Z.
Gen Z, well, we're not American.
Gen Z, exactly. So Gen Z, I think, very interesting. And once again, it's there's a trap to be caught in to think that they are the same, male and female, because they can be completely different,
yeah.
Right? As we discovered with the whole American election, where the males, sort of from that new voters, et cetera, targeted. But I think they have very different sentiments. You know, they're not loyal. They switch very easily. They tend to drink less. There's this whole sober curious. Everybody's wondering about this no low alcohol shift. But, you know, they're still young. So how is this going to play out in the next 20 years? We don't really know.
So the Rabobank released a report this week,
yes,
where they said just basically living patterns have changed. And so you're, yes, seeing in America, in North America anyway, you're seeing far more people stuck at home because they can't afford to move out. And that's having a big impact. So they said they believe that that age group will take up alcohol. They didn't,
yes,
specify wine, but they'll do it later than other groups.
Yeah, that's quite possible. But this whole idea that they're not that interested in provenance, which might also change, and they switch quite easily, even between wine, beer, and spirits. Occasion becomes a very important lifestyle, health, is an important trigger for them. But really, like, I think the important thing, what some people are saying, is that they are prepared to spend more on wine.
Yeah.
Provided it provides what we call this transcendent value, right? This speaks to their values, because they buy on the basis of values, not in a way as I choose this wine over that because it has certain attributes. The alignment of values is very important. So identity is incredibly important to I think this generation, and brand identity, it becomes incredibly important conversation to have. But as I said, it's not a homogenous grouping. And the other thing is that they're still young, and is their behavior going to change over time? Well, that's up to the jury.
We've been talking for ages. So, Jonathan, any last thoughts about when you look across the landscape of the wine trade, people are really panicking at the moment about falling consumption. And, you know, some of that is obviously cost of living, but, you know, some of it might be changing taste as well. What are your final thoughts? What do you think, if you wanted to get wine people in a room and calm them down, what would you tell them that they should be thinking about?
Well, I think that I think they should explore, like we teach on our course, hopefully we're reflecting that, is sort of find new ways to collaborate effectively. And I think then create the capabilities to innovate, right? And I think that that's around what you were talking about, I guess, in on your educational seminar, is how do we skill people for the future in the wine business? Because we're sort of going through the same way of teaching people as we have in the last, you know, few decades. And that needs to shift, and it needs to adapt to a very new world that's changing radically every day. And you need to build the strength and the resilience and the capabilities to be able to work effectively in that world.
Yeah, so I had a conversation with somebody from California the other day. We were talking about at the cellar door, and I said it's a real problem going into cellar doors where the staff are working to a single script, and they don't recognize this person's a wine expert, this person doesn't know anything that, you know, that, people should be trained that way. And he said, we don't have the money to do that. And I was like, well, if you don't prioritize that, then how do you imagine you're going to stay in business? To me, that seems like foundational.
I think the other opportunity, or the thing that they should, is like research. You know, you have to do your research. You can't just assume. And people say, well, we don't have the money for big research. You know, we had a consumer behavior seminar, and most of these people had tasting rooms. And are you actually using the data that's on your doorstep to find out, you know, what are people's triggers? What are their symptoms? How are things changing? How can I best serve my particular target market that I've chosen? So I think research is incredibly important.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be expensive. Last year I interviewed Heidi Dillon from Diageo, and she said she goes out to bars and just watches people, what they're drinking. You know. 100%. Okay. On that note, Jonathan, I've taken up quite a lot of your time. It's been a fantastic conversation, and thank you. Thank you very much.
Only a pleasure, Felicity. Thank you. Have a great day.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome. Thank you.